We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And today we are looking at the Blake 7 episode, Sarcophagus, by Tanith Lee. Death, the final frontier. No, it's space. Death and space, the final frontiers. No, never mind. Let's start again. An alien race prepares a funeral ship. Before it departs, magic apparitions of an urn bearer, a jester, a musician, and a protector appear to join the dead body on its journey. Death also appears, but is banished. A very long time later, the Liberator finds the ship drifting in space. Callie senses something, but denies that she did. Tarrant is suspicious, but he's also bored, and he wants to investigate the ship. Avon deliberately cuts him out of the investigation. On board the alien ship, Avon, Callie, and Villa discover the dead body. Callie steals the ring, and they collect the one piece of equipment that hasn't decayed. The ship begins to self-destruct, and only Callie can teleport off the ship. She returns to save the others in the nick of time. But soon, something begins to merge minds with Callie, and with the help of the mysterious device, begins to form a new body for the dead alien. Weird things happen. People get mad at each other. Avon ultimately kisses the alien to death. The end. Oh, but Avon is totally going to get some from Callie after this escapade.
So, a conversation
that I've not wanted to have on Fusion Patrol. I think we've 6 years, and I've been trying to avoid this conversation. But today, we are not going to be able to avoid that conversation. But for now, what did you think of the very first episode of Blake 7 written by a woman?
Boring, dull, and pointless.
So you loved it, I guess.
You know, I would just say this. Okay, first episode written by writer Tanith Lee. She will only write one more episode for next season.
Don't go into that one.
But then she only wrote one more TV episode ever for the series The Hunger.
The Hunger. I'm not familiar with that series, but
neither am I. But that's
a vampire show, isn't it?
I think it is. But that's kind of the whole point here. She's only ever written three things.
Well, I mean, apart from 90 novels and 300 short stories and 3 British Fantasy Awards.
Well, yeah. I'm talking television.
Right. Television. Yes, she's not written a lot of television, but I mean, she is a writer with some standing.
You wouldn't know by this.
This is very fantasy.
Huh? Oh, it's fantasy? You're being kind.
I'm calling it what I see it. It's a bunch of mystical mumbo jumbo with a lot of pointless sort of magic-y stuff in it.
It's just a bunch of BS. I'm not going to hold my cards here. I really disliked this episode.
I've been dreading this episode since we started. I don't know that I hate it.
I don't hate it. I mean, no, this is not Naked Montague hate. I'm just like, wow, this was lower than scraping the bottom of the barrel.
So here's what, if there's anything in it that I like, and I'm typically not really somebody that enjoys this sort of thing. I like my characters to be consistent in a TV show. I really dislike normally when a different writer comes in and basically screws up a character.
Right.
That they don't get what they were like for the last 30 episodes. So why do you not get it? So in that respect, I would normally say I don't like this, but I feel like in this instance, Tanith was actually probably had watched all of the show or at least all of the show up to the produced point where she wrote her episode, and took notes, and tried to stretch the characters just a little bit and keep them consistent. But unfortunately, she's playing with old Tarrant there, for starters. You know, at the beginning of the year, the suspicious, I don't trust anybody, I'm a jerk all the time,
right,
Tarrant. And of course, Avon in his hyper Avon mode throughout most of the episode, except when he's like comforting Callie at the beginning.
Yes, I noticed that.
Clearly, there is no other word for it here. They're shipping.
Definitely in this episode.
We've seen it before. We've mentioned it. We've said, I don't know, there's like, it's too easy to convince Villa that those two have something going on. There's too many little weird lines where Callie says something like, you think I'm staying here because of him? Why would you, you know, single Avon out, etc.? I mean, there's been all these little sort of clues, but it's so much more.
Oh, it's more than that.
Obvious
this.
In this.
Oh, yeah. And it's the crux.
She drags it out. She calls it out and said, this is a thing. Callie has a thing for Avon.
And it's the thing that Avon banks on to basically save the day.
Right. So she's brought something out that we've seen the writers play with. And again, that's the one part that I appreciate is that this doesn't come out of left field.
No, it doesn't. It's just a further development of something that's already there. In fact, I would go so far to say that that's probably the one thing that I found fascinating. And I don't mean that in a, oh, that's fascinating. No, I mean, it's like, it was fascinating.
In an ORAC fascinating. It's fascinating.
It's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I kind of liked it.
There's also that bit where Avon and Tarrant are squaring off. And they're having their minds bigger than yours contest. And
oh, yeah.
It does feel like that is the underlying tension between those two. Tarrant considers himself to be an awesome success. And frankly, in a way, Avon does too. I think Avon considers himself to be very competent.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't like the flash. He doesn't like the bravado that we get out of Tarrant. And again, she brings that. Yes, it's the alien kind of provoking that, but we do get that brought to the fore so that we can have that little contest between the two of them there on the bridge,
right,
or the flight deck. Less so is Dana and Villa.
Yes,
not much done with those two. I didn't even know Dana could sing.
No, that one came out of left field. While I guess this is not really the first time we've seen something kind of magician-like with Villa, the whole, I don't know, what we saw out of him in this one just felt really more than out of left field.
Except he's being mind-controlled, right?
That's a good question. I wasn't even quite sure about that, or if he was just somehow tapping into something that was subliminally there already.
You know, when you consider the magic act for the empty room,
it's his way of dealing with stress, supposedly. I mean, or, you know, with the stress of the situation. That's kind of how I was reading it.
I was thinking maybe both.
It might be.
You know, but is this the one that has the line where the alien, you know, points out that Villa is actually very intelligent?
Yes.
But hides behind one.
Hides behind stupidity or something like that.
Yeah. So, of course, she's kind of zapping into their minds. And clearly, Tarrant has a dove fetish because he wants to hold her dove. And
I think we need to put an explicit tag on this episode now.
It is interesting to see somebody pull the characters just a little bit further. It would be interesting to see what she would have done with Dana, but it's just like she knew nothing about her.
Yeah,
we don't know much about her either because they haven't given her much to do.
Well, Dana's been pretty two-dimensional since the beginning, so yeah, there's really not much to go with.
Yeah. And then Callie, of course, is asleep most of the episode. But
Again,
here, Jane Dapple gets a chance to have a bigger part, like she did in, was the last one, Children of Arn? I remember.
Yeah.
One or two episodes back. And they don't let it be her character. They bring it out as somebody else.
Right.
Although she does get kind of half the episode being kind of nice. Doing things. Effectively doing things.
Hmm.
Well, shoot. Let's do it.
Okay.
I've had this discussion, not this particular discussion, but I think somewhere along the line I've had part of this discussion with Simon over the insistence that we have to have more female writers on science fiction. And my counterpoint, which of course is not always taken as being the feminist view, is that I don't care who the writer is.
As long as they're good.
The writer is irrelevant in most cases to me. I don't care if they're black or white or male or female or
no, the demographic.
It doesn't really matter. The writer is a person who takes a story and puts it on the page that speaks to me.
Right.
And so now here is the question. Does this story not speak to me because this is a different style of writing because Tanith Lee is a woman, or is it because I don't like Tanith Lee's work?
It's just, no, there is absolutely zero doubt in this. Tanith Lee's gender is entirely irrelevant. It is the fact that Tanith Lee simply isn't a good writer, at least from what we've seen. I mean, if this episode is any indication as to Tanith Lee's writing ability, then Tanith Lee is not a good writer. I am familiar with female writers that are very, very, very good. I know some personally. This person, Tanith Lee, just isn't one of them. Gender, it means nothing.
Of course it means
It's something. All about talent.
Of course it means something. Your perspective does
not mine.
Taint your... Well, how would you know? How much of your life have you spent as a woman to know how you would see the world differently? And that
it's
is
not,
the
no,
question.
That's not – no, not in my case, not in how I view it. I simply view it in this. Does it speak to me? It doesn't matter if the person is female or male. I have read excellent literary work from male writers that has spoken to me. I have read excellent work from female writers that has spoken to me. When I go into reading a book or watching a show, it does not matter. I go in there gender blind. Now, if somebody else doesn't, well, that's on them, but I do. So I don't give a crap if Tanith Lee is female or not. Her gender meant nothing to me. What does matter is that her story was garbage.
And you don't see an emphasis to different aspects of the story.
To be honest, I thought Tanith Lee was a guy. I didn't care. I don't give a crap about gender.
What about Anne Rice?
I actually like Anne Rice, but not because Anne Rice is a female. I thought Anne Rice has written some very interesting stuff.
Do you not feel it has a different perspective?
I don't notice one. I don't notice one. It's just, is it good? That is my criteria. Is it good?
How do you define
perspective?
Good?
It's all about what appeals to me.
Aww.
Perspective means nothing. Do I like it?
Wait, perspective means nothing. So in other words, if someone's perspective is...
Let me put it this way. I have read work from male writers, I have read work from female writers, and I have not been able to differentiate them and have loved them both equally.
All right, let's change it to conservative and liberal writers.
Are we talking politics?
Not necessarily politics, but in other words, if you're reading books by Bob Heinlein, obviously you're going to get... some of his uber military stuff sometimes.
Heinlein bores me.
Well, that's his perspective.
But no, Heinlein's writing style bores me. It's not the content. It is the writing style, the manner. in which it is presented to me, if I cannot be fully engrossed based on the manner in which the story is being presented to me, then I get bored and I walk away. Now, I have read female writers who have managed to do the same thing to me, too. See, it does not matter. It's how well are you able to present your story to me. The perspective is irrelevant.
So you're saying that's what grabs me. The technical quality of their writing.
Yes.
Not the concepts or the world that they're trying to create.
Not necessarily.
Hmm. Interesting.
See, I don't give a crap about gender. And this is something that really kind of pisses the crap out of me when people try to project that on me. Oh, that makes me angry. That makes me really angry when somebody else has a different value and believes that's the kind of value or that's the kind of viewpoint that everybody else must have. I say BS to that because that's not true. I don't operate that way. I don't think that way. And I don't look at this episode that way. And I don't look at Tanith Lee's writing on this one episode that way. I just simply look at the story as, did it impress me? I'm watching it and I didn't give a... The idea of Tanith Lee's gender never entered into my head as I am watching this show. All I saw was, this is a story that has got absolutely nothing connecting. I don't get these characters that I'm seeing here. I don't get what the point is. The only thing that has any kind of resonance to me is this thing between Callie and Avon. Nothing else is resonating with me in any way, shape, or form. I'm sitting here watching thinking, what am I supposed to get out of this? I'm not getting it. That is what I went with. End of story.
Do you not acknowledge that a stereotype exists that romance novels and stories are predominantly the domain of women?
No.
You don't believe that stereotype exists?
No, because
exists.
You're talking to a gay man.
But you don't believe that stereotype exists?
I honestly don't know because I don't – well, I have no idea. I really don't know because I don't follow the romance novel genre. But I do know that there are some men that have written them.
Oh yeah,
primarily for the male audience. But I mean, but then I also know of women who have also written for gay male audience as well. So as far as I'm concerned, in that genre, it's split 50-50.
Interesting.
This is getting to be bad.
I'm curious because this is the first episode where they have played up the romance angle in any episode of Blake 7. And without trying to skip the timeline, because I don't want to, but the next one is Sand. And
that's next year's, isn't it?
Yeah. The next one that does it is Sand. And it is what it is.
I have no idea what it is. The title meant nothing to me.
Terrible title, yeah.
And when I think I took a quick look at the synopsis in IMDb, and it didn't click.
Well, we'll get there. Obviously, we will get there. But anyway, all right. Well, I bring it up because it seems like she's pandering to the stereotype.
Well, if that's the case, I have nothing to comment on that because that's not what I got out of it.
But you did get Callie and Avon.
I did, but that's not how I viewed it. I viewed it as somebody being smart. I mean, this is what I was getting, that Tanith had the smarts to at least try to capitalize on something that had been played with in the past and use it as the plot point to try and save the day. I didn't see it as just covert or overt attempt to try and capitalize on some kind of romantic shtick. I didn't get that.
Okay. So, putting aside bad writing, clearly this story has a lot more mystic. I'll use mystic as best I can there.
Well, I suppose.
What the heck was going on there at the beginning with the ceremony and the faceless people being
I don't know.
Materialized?
I didn't get any of that. In fact, my actual quote was this quasi-religious ceremony makes no sense, and what is with this whimsical moment with lighthearted music? I mean, I know it, and I even added that the introduction was annoying me. And I didn't like the talking magician moment either. It was too weird. Talking, and the endless scarf gag.
Magician moment.
Did the magician talk?
Yeah, there was actual speaking of some kind, and it was too bizarre, and I hated the endless scarf thing.
Wow, I don't remember any of them speaking, but all right. I thought it was a nice. It was a nice touch on the scarf. I took in my notes that the scarf does appear to be of a similar material to the accoutrements that the people are wearing, and that wasn't just a bog standard BBC magician's scarf that they got from, you know, the back room, the prop department. It said, "Oh, magician scarf, here you go." I mean, it was actually had texture to it. It matched the stuff. At least they thought of that. I wish they had done something with the dove to make it look like an alien death bird.
Yeah, that would have been better. Just instead of just a dove.
That was a little bit.
That was lame.
You know, maybe like a little furry horn on its
something,
head.
Something to make it, you know, because yeah, I see a dove. I'm like, oh, okay, it's a dove. It's an earth bird.
Uh-huh.
Yet clearly, this is not some
not
human.
Earth.
This is not Earth that we're dealing with, obviously. So yeah, that was just that only added to the big case of huh as I was watching it.
So we watched the opening, and we see the dead body. We see the urn bearer, who is obviously the keeper of the body, the keeper of the flame, the life, or whatever, who will ultimately be Callie, which appears to be a manifestation from the woman's
hand. If you say so, because I couldn't understand any of that.
It looked like when she was using her hand to put out the torches, probably because of the special effects they used, it looked like it was some sort of a technology thing. As opposed to magic. Does that would go that
maybe,
far?
I mean, maybe. Again, that entire sequence made zero sense to me.
Well, so, it was explained later that was the foretelling of the future.
That still didn't help me any.
Yeah, well, and then it came true. So why did they bother if they knew death was coming?
Again, none of this made any sense to me. I mean, and I come back to the idea, or come back to what I was saying. This really just reeks of bad writing. I mean, you said, I think you're accurate in that. Clearly, Tanith, you know, she understood that there was something that had been played with in terms of her friendship, at least between Callie and Avon. But everything else in this really gives the impression that she knew nothing of what Blake 7 was supposed to be and was making it up on the fly.
You know, it's like, where did she must have gotten it from somewhere. And she must have seen or read something to do with Tarrant, because he is back to his early Tarrant personality. So
that's true.
I don't know how the writing schedule works on the show, whether or not a few episodes are already out by the time they get it, or whether they get to read some scripts. Because if you were anybody coming in on the third series, would, if they did it before the show was produced, would not know Tarrant at all.
True.
Because he's a completely new character. So she kind of got him, but I don't know where she got him from. It feels like the first, maybe, Volcano power play. Mm-hmm. Remember Volcano? I don't trust anybody. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was the episode where he was picking on Callie about being an alien.
Yeah.
There was one of those, too, earlier on. You're always really feelings. I can't remember where that episode was, but he was kind of harping on her. So it's almost like she lifted them right off the pages and just kind of amped them up a bit. I'm gonna read just a paragraph here out of the the Wikipedia entry on her writing style. which is odd that they have a paragraph on her writing style.
I didn't even bother to look that up.
Lee's style is frequently remarked upon for its use of rich poetic prose and striking imagery. Critics describe her style as weird, lush, vibrant, exotic, erotic, rich, elegant, perverse, and darkly beautiful. The technique she uses is very descriptive and poetic, which works well with the themes she uses in her mystical stories. She has been praised for her ability to balance her weird style with the challenges of writing a faraway world. But some critics counter that her style is not always easy on the reader. She sometimes leaves the reader with unanswered questions that could have easily been answered if she had gone into greater detail. I can kind of see that in this story. The latter part, not the first part. I don't get the rich poetic prose.
No, I don't get any of that.
You wouldn't because it's not prose.
No. unless they're talking about the actual, you know, her short stories.
Yeah.
I mean, things like that where
the vast body of her work is
right. It's all literary. Not meant for the TV or film or I mean, I'm guessing that there was very little of her other work's been adapted.
I don't know. I haven't looked. But her bibliography is massive. And some interesting stories here.
Well, the more stuff you write, the more crap you put out.
Certainly true with Stephen King.
Yes, I agree completely. I mean, just because you're prolific doesn't mean you're good.
Now, like I said, she won the 1980 British Fantasy Award, and she won the 1983 and 84, I believe, World Fantasy Awards. Although I don't see which books off the top of my head. Those were four. And she was a huge fan of Doctor Who. But apparently never wrote for it.
Oh, well, thank God for that. I mean, if what we saw in if this one episode of Blake Seven is any indication, then thank God she has not written anything for Doctor Who.
Well, she won't write anything now. She's dead. But
well, thank God for that even. I'm sorry. That was evil. That was evil.
That was pretty cold, Ben.
Yeah, that was harsh. I'll cop to that. That was harsh. I'm sorry. But at least Doctor Who is now spared the possibility of her pen cursing any episode worse than it deserves to be.
Let's see. Was there anything else in this episode? We certainly have that long, smoldering look between Avon and Callie at the end of the episode. Do you think that having established this, we're going to see it again?
I hope not.
Or will it completely go away? Did everything we see build up to this and then that killed it?
Well, you mean the relationship, the friendship? You know, that's a good... I don't think we're going to see it progress any further or even remain where it was left off at this episode. I think it'll probably be reset to something to a little bit more toned down to where it has been over the past, you know, number of episodes. That's my guess.
So let's talk a little bit about Avon coming in to comfort her at the beginning of the episode about the death of everyone on Auron, which is kind of interesting because even though we've had this story arc, like the Star One story arc, etc., they don't dwell a lot on the past.
No.
They tend to be about what's going to happen in the future.
Right.
So, you know, we're still looking for Star One and, you know, maybe just a brief word, well, we got that from so-and-so, but here we actually have a repercussion for the death of Auron, which is a planet. And when I say the death of Auron, I mean the total annihilation by genocide by Servalan of the planet's inhabitants of Auron. But Avon's, I mean, talk about the most incompetent person for coming in and trying to, I don't even know what the word comfort someone over a loss. I mean, Avon is such an odd...
He's not the nurturing type.
No, and yet he makes the effort in this episode. Although,
well, he's not heartless. We know that. He just it's just deeply buried. But I think there are just some people he chooses not to lower his shields to, if you know what I mean.
Everybody but Anna Grant. Oops. Maybe that's what it is.
You know, and it probably it would make sense. Now, I don't know. I mean, if this is something that had, you know, if either Terry Nation or
wrong. We actually got them wrong. They were the other order. Children of Aron, then Rumors of Death.
Oh.
So Callie gets destroyed, then Aven gets destroyed. Two episodes in a row, and now we get this one. Hmm. Actually,
they're both feeling a little vulnerable.
It actually kind of fits.
You know, in that respect, okay, I could go with that.
It actually kind of fits. So, so the question is this. Has anything been going on with those two? Or is it just like, they're, you know, the will she, will they, won't they kind of, I mean, let's face it. It's a pretty small ship and
people have
their
needs.
Adults and what are they doing on that ship when they're bored? I don't know. We've never seen anything except Space Monopoly and that game they were playing in this episode, which was not Space Monopoly.
I don't think they're finding, you know, I don't think they're, you know, planet hopping looking for any
mm-mm.
interplanetary bunny ranch, if you know what I mean.
Nope. I don't. I think it may have been a real thing prior to this, and I am not. I am
it's
absolutely
like,
not
I guess.
A shipper.
No. Right. What? No, I'm not.
I never do that with TV shows. I'm just not one of those ones. I was like, huh, Scholder and Mulder got together? Or Mulder and Scully got together? Oh, my God. I would never expected that. But
no, to me, that spells doom and gloom to any TV show.
Typically it does. Unless they've played it very low, like they have this one.
Well, yeah. You know, and this is not the first time I've actually asked myself that question, if there had been something going on between those two. Yeah, that's a really tough question. I really got to say no. And I think the reason being is I think, in all honesty, I think Callie would reject him. I think Callie would, you know, would look at Aven favorably to some degree, but this is, I think, the most that we've ever seen her review him, in, you know, fondly, shall we say. I mean, to that level. I mean, now this episode, based on this alone, well, if I had nothing else to go on, I'd say, well, it's an distinct possibility. But prior to this one, I would have said no.
Hmm.
Because I just don't think, I mean, Aven, even though he has had, I mean, I think you kind of hit on it, especially with Aven. And Anna Grant, that whole thing. Avon's not one who really likes to expose himself. You know, and I mean, you know, emotionally and psychologically, it's not his thing. Ever since the whole Anna Grant bit, I mean, he's got that wall up around him, and it's painted in bitterness. So I just couldn't see him lowering that for anybody in the slightest, no matter how he may have felt for them, except for possibly Servalon. But even then, I think there would be an ulterior motive to that.
Hmm. I mean, obviously, we are seeing him lower his guard in
this one. He does
in this scene.
Yeah, he does here. There's no question. I mean, that's so.
So then, all right. How strongly does he think he can? Obviously, he thinks he can play his hand pretty strongly, because he comes in there at the end of the episode. And basically says, you know, kill me. And we get...
He was fairly confident. I mean, that was clearly...
He was very confident.
That was the biggest bluff imaginable.
Unless because it wasn't a bluff.
Well, it wasn't a bluff, not really. I mean, but you know what I mean. I mean, he had every confidence... Yeah, you're right. It was not a bluff. He had every confidence that the Callie inside would never allow that to happen.
That's very... how do I put this? That would make Aven, if he and Callie had not had something, I don't necessarily mean it has to be overtly sexual, but in other words, if he and Callie don't have some sort of mutually expressed special bond between them, that's very touchy-feely for him to be relying on the emotions of another person without factual data.
Which makes that move a calculated, I don't know, not even calculated risk. It's a gamble. It's a huge gamble. And that's not quite on that kind of level. You're right. Avon has always been about playing the odds, especially when he knows that they're in his favor. And this one, based on past episodes, you know, and then you throw this one into the mix, I find it to be a very risky move for Avon to assume that Callie would have strong enough feelings for him to thwart the plans of her possessor, shall we say.
And her possessor is really, you know, she's tied into Callie's mind. She's receiving Callie's emotions.
Yeah.
And boy, she puts it pretty clearly, you know, Callie wouldn't want to hurt you, Avon. Especially not you, Avon.
Yeah, so clearly she's telling us.
Her favorite.
Right. And maybe that was the move that Avon was, the opening, shall we say, the strategic opening that Avon was looking for in order to press his advantage. Man, there's a lot of really bad words that are being used here in this conversation.
So, she throws a tantrum, electric bolts flying all over the place, but ultimately she cannot kill him. And again, as weird as the scene in Aftermath, I guess it was, where he just sort of suddenly swoops in and kisses Servalan. He does that here with the Callie alien creature. I'm not convinced by Paul Darrow's leading man kissing.
No, not his strength.
It's not his strength, as best I can tell. I don't know. I think he's going for like Clark Gable kind of tall leading man sort of.
And herein lies the problem, because that's not his acting strength. It makes it virtually impossible to tell what Avon's motivations are. I mean, is he doing it as a means to emotionally connect to Callie in some way, or I mean, in a really genuine sort of way, or is this some kind of psychological confusion trick, shall we say, in order to let Callie regain control? I mean, I can't get a read on Avon, because Paul Darrow's acting in this one, in that particular scene, does not play very well.
It's stoic. Let's call it stoic.
Okay. I guess that's being nice. Stoic isn't the word that I would have used, but okay, I'll go with it.
And of course, he's only doing it to steal. Well, is he only doing it to steal the ring?
And that's the big question.
Or as you say, is he attempting to seal up that connection to Callie?
And at the same, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I can't get a read on him, because this is not something that Paul Darrow is very good with. You know, you don't exactly equate him in the romantic lead role. I've never seen him in one, at least.
I have only seen him in a couple of other things apart from Blake 7. And one of those was Time Lash.
Ditto.
And, you know.
He's
having fun with that.
That's snarky. I mean, there's no romanticism going on in that guy.
And so, of course, if the communication is two ways, which I believe she says it is, so clearly he is also kissing Callie. At the same time,
yeah.
She is completely aware of what he did. When the alien dies,
does Callie? Well, I would imagine Callie she would have standing, to retain that knowledge.
Callie is standing there.
Yeah,
which means she woke up before that point and then came to the flight deck. So somewhere prior to the point where the ring is destroyed, something woke her up. Was it Avon's kiss?
But she was fighting it off early. We know that. I have to think it was probably the kiss. I can't think of what else it might be. But it could have been. I have to watch it again now, because didn't she wake up after the ring was removed? from the hand?
I don't know. Did we see her wake up? I don't remember if we saw her wake up.
I don't think we saw
We saw her tossing and turning, but I don't remember.
I don't think we saw her wake up. I think I just assumed that it was the removal of the ring that did it, because that's where all the power was.
Even going with a kiss as the thing that woke her up, she got to the flight deck pretty quick.
Yes, she did.
So it could have been the point where they were trying to kill Avon and she couldn't do it, and that may have been what broke the power right there. I don't know. But I do not believe that chucking that whacking great ring into a clearly plastic cellophane ripped up console and then have a little puff go destroyed that ring.
Well, this is another one of these literary licenses where I was like, okay, yeah, if I'm going to take that literally, yes, that's lame, but this is the BBC. Cheap budget. And I mean, that's if you look at BBC, you know, 1970s BBC, you will see the definition cheap budget. And I'm thinking, okay, cheap budget. It probably was meant to be something more significant, something more powerful, something different than what we got. But this is all they could give us. So I gave it a massive hand wave.
Speaking of cheap budget, the Liberator set is not looking that good.
No, I noticed that too.
It kind of looks like it's falling apart.
I noticed that too, and I was actually disappointed.
And they blew up a whole lot of stuff.
They did.
On this one. And I'm wondering if they had to do like 10 takes, and they're just basically blowing the heck
blowing the crap out of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really good question, because I remember when we started the series, and Blake,
beautiful set.
Yeah. Well, when Blake, Jenna, and Avon first board Liberator and we see that bridge, I remember, I mean, it just took my breath away. I thought it looked so gorgeous. You know, and it's not because I didn't know what the bridge looked like. Of course, I knew what the bridge looked like. I had seen enough Blake 7 to recognize what it looks like. And it was interesting that you mentioned that, because I was thinking that very thing as I was watching it, watching this episode, and wondering, why am I not getting that sense of, oh my God, this set looks gorgeous? Well, it's because it's had the crap beaten out of it.
It is. It's looking a little
really worn, and
there's places where the upholstery looks like it's been torn, and on the seats and patched. And I mean,
it's definitely in need of some dry dock.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know that I have anything else. This has been a bizarre episode. A weird excursion into a different reality. And so where does this rate on your list of Blake 7 episodes now that I've heard rather forcefully that you really didn't like this episode?
You know, and I've seen some that I thought were just really bad, but this one I'm going to have to put at the bottom, only because the method of the storytelling was just so disconnected and made absolutely not one shred of sense. I mean, even other episodes like, I can't even think of the name of it now. The one after Gan dies, that one.
Oh, Trial.
Trial, yeah. What was it? Just a trial? The one where Blake exiles himself.
Yeah, Trial.
Yeah. As weird as that was, at least there was some kind of cohesiveness to the story. I mean, it was badly executed visually, but at least the story narrative had made sense in of itself. This really did not. Not really. I mean, okay, I kind of get where it was supposed to go, but there are so many other scenes in here that I'm still wondering what they were supposed to be about. So,
like a flying musical instrument?
Yeah. Well, things like that. I mean, but things connected to that. So I have to rate this as probably the worst Blake 7 episode that I can remember.
All right, I'll just throw a couple at you here. The Web?
You know, as weird as The Web was, again, No, I have to. I would watch that over this.
Weapon with Emmy Pack.
Bad, but not as bad as this.
Let's see. Hostage was pretty dire.
Yeah, but not as bad as this.
Not as bad as this, yeah. And the only one else I can think of that just really, well, Volcano had its issues, but oh, what the heck? It's not here. Dawn of the Gods.
You know, I would watch that over this one. I'm serious. I mean, this is an episode. If I never see it again, I won't miss it because it does not really connect. I mean, except for the fact that, okay, yeah, we get more about Callie and the whole Auron thing. But outside of that, there is nothing that I think really connects it to past episodes, nor did they build on or did they establish anything that future episodes can build on, at least not that I could see. I mean, from what I could remember, obviously now, yeah, from what I remember, I can't think of a single episode that draws from Sarcophagus. But now, of course, I haven't seen, and I don't remember Sand. So
it's not a sequel in any way. It's
oh, thank different. It's God, completely totally independent. Okay, so based on that, I would say, you know, you could take this, you could completely exclude this episode from the entire Blake 7 series run, and it would not be missed.
Yeah, but this is the episode that gives us Space is Just a Starry Night. Where no suns ever rise. I mean, isn't that so profound?
No, not really. No. No, but you know what it gives? It gives us. Hold on to your horses, Kayvon.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you that. It was my last question. Is it Kayvon or is it Avalli?
I like Kayvon better. It sounds more dire.
So the question is: have we been the first people to coin that? And obviously, I can look that up on the
Google it.
Google right now. And do we have? No, we don't have anything that says Kayvon with Blake 7. Yes, one of those exciting episodes where we Google at people.
Yeah.
Nope, there's no Kayvon that I can.
Hey, we may have started something. We need to patent that now.
Avalli. No, I'm not finding anything. Wow. So, I think either we're the only two people that noticed, and I don't think that's possible.
Now I find that hard to believe.
So do I. Or no one has bothered to do that stupid shipping thing that they do with the names.
Hmm. Well, so, I mean, it's possible because that whole shipping thing, I mean, that's a rather, I mean, relatively new idea, a new concept, you know, to ship, you know, where did that term come from?
I actually know where that came from.
Where did that come from?
I had to look it up.
Because I honestly don't know.
Okay. I had to look it up because Michelle uses it.
Oh, just God, she needs to be stopped.
And the funny thing was that she asked, we're making her watch X-Files, and she asked me early on if Mulder and Scully get together. And of course, I'm not going to tell her what the case was. And, you know, she was talking about shipping this stuff. And I thought, when did they start not calling it Slash? And so which of course I know was in its original form, had its homoerotic connotations to that terminology in the K/S stuff from Kirk and Spock. And so I started researching it. And it turns out, first off, ship is short for relationshipping.
Oh, really? Is that it?
That's where it is. And do you know where it came from?
I'm afraid to find out.
The X-Files.
You're kidding.
Nope.
Wow. I did not know that.
I didn't hear the term at the time, so I hear it all the time now.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, that's what it is.
Wow. I'm
and I am, of course, quoting internet research on that, so not first sources, but.
Right.
I think it may have been Wikipedia, though, so it's, you know, as close to a first source as you can get on the internet. Anyway, when we come back, I think, for Blake 7, I think we're going to be talking about Ultra World, another Stone Cold Solid classic Blake 7 episode.
Okay, so now you've got me terrified when you call it that.
Well, anyway, Ben, thank you for joining me.
Oh, it was a joy.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Please consider becoming our sponsor at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Search for us on Facebook under Fusion Patrol. Check out our Twitter handle, @FusionPatrol. Or just send us an email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Please come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.